Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the term gaslighting comes from the 1944 film Gaslight, about an abusive husband who secretly manipulates the lighting in his house in order to drive his wife mad.
He said I wasn't any litter. He said I was going out of my mind.
You're not going out of your mind. You're slowly and systematically being driven out of your mind.
But why? Why?
Ingrid Bergman's character didn't appreciate the gaslight effect especially, and neither would we. Gaslighting has been used more recently to refer to a political phenomenon involving the dissemination of untruths to an extent that causes the public to doubt truth from falsehood. University of Washington professors Christopher Sebastian Parker and David Domke joined Wellspring Family Services Vice President Keith Myers to discuss the question, is President Trump gaslighting us? They spoke at Town Hall Seattle on February 27th. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. Here, Town Hall Seattle's Ware Harmon introduces the program.
Keith Myers is the Vice President for Clinical and Training Services at Wellspring Family Services. He's been with Wellspring for 30 years and is responsible for almost 30, actually. He is responsible for approximately 65 staff in four branches, offering a full range of individual, couples, and family counseling services. He's been central in developing the agency's new focus on infant mental health and is also an associate professor at the University of Washington in the School of Social Work. After a career as a journalist for papers including the Orange County Register and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, David Domke is now, and has been for a while, I suppose I should know more specifically than a while, but at any rate, he's been a professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Washington. He is currently the department's chair. In 2002, he received the University of Washington's Distinguished Teaching Award, the university's highest honor in teaching. In 2006, he was named Washington State Professor of the Year by the Council for Advancement and Support of Education and the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. He is the author of two books, 2004's God Willing and 2010's The God Strategy, How Religion Became a Weapon in America. Christopher Sebastian Parker is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the UW. His first book, Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South, was the winner of the American Political Science Association's Ralph J. Bunche Award. His second book, Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America, explores the beliefs, attitudes, and behavior of the Tea Party, and was published in 2013, also winning the American Political Science Association's award for the best book on race, ethnicity, and politics for that year. He's currently at work, he wants you to know, on two, count them, two books, as you might expect, about the current occupant of the Oval Office, one with Matt Barreto, the working party being from Tea Party to Trump, drawing just a laser line. And then the latest book that he's writing, Alone, he didn't tell me much about what it's about, but we might be able to deduce it's called White Fright. So we were proud to host Chris in 2013 for Change They Can't Believe In, as we have been proud to host him and Professor Domke numerous times over my 12 years in this job, both together and independently as speakers. And Keith Myers joins that august club, I guess, here for the first time tonight. Please join me in welcoming, I think it's going to happen this way, Christopher Sebastian Parker, and then he will be joined by Keith Myers and David Domke. Thanks.
Ooh-wee. What happened to those flying cars they promised us 30 years ago? All right. Wow, it's a thrill and pleasure to be here once again before you. I've been up here a couple times before with my colleague David Domke. It's my first time having a pleasure with Keith. So can we give them a round of applause once again? I suppose I should ask for mine in advance as well, because I'm not sure how many. If you are a Trump supporter, a Trump fan, you are not going to like me when this is all done. And as I told my colleagues that we discussed during our little briefing backstage, you know, last night it seemed like the Academy Awards, you know, for the most part, tried to avoid politics. However, this is a manifestly political topic, and so I can't speak for my colleagues, but I'm all in head first on this, and I think they're going to follow suit. Okay, so the name of the presentation tonight, I took the liberty of entitling it, it was, I think this belongs, this phrase, to make a proper attribution to Groucho Marx. Are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? Gaslighting in government in Trump's America. So, without any further ado, we're already running late given traffic, so I'm just going to dive right in if you don't mind. So, the definition: to drive someone insane by making them doubt their perceptions or memories. Sounds kind of like marriage to me, but what do I know? You guys know I'm telling the truth. Don't even lie, all right? All right, so here are some examples. So we have the first one is the quote-unquote birther claim.
So just to finish up, you see what's happening? The process is rigged. This whole election is being rigged. These lies spread by the media, without witnesses, without backup or anything else, are poisoning the minds of the electorate. No witnesses, no backup, no anything else. And I'm telling you, I have many top professionals. Don't talk about this, Donald. Nobody believes. I said, maybe some do believe it.
My high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you the President-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
So let us move on. So the whole point to that is that Trump is making this the rigged election claim, rather, after he's already been elected.
And welcome back to Hannity. We continue with Donald Trump. I did not want to bring this up because every person that interviews you goes right for the birth certificate issue, which, by the way, you did win.
I did. And he released it.
They finally...
Whatever it was he released. You know, some people don't know what it was that he released, and I'm not sure what he released, but...
There's one line called place of birth. I'd like to see what he said.
A lot of people want me to talk about place of birth. You saw this audience. Probably the biggest hand I got was when I mentioned place of birth.
Many people do not think it was authentic. His mother was not in the hospital. There were many other things that came out.
Okay, I thought the birth issue was established, that you were satisfied.
I wasn't satisfied. I never said I was satisfied. I never
told you
that I was satisfied.
I want to see
who's satisfied.
You don't still question that he was born in the United States, do you?
I have no idea.
Even at this point?
I don't know. Was it a birth certificate? You tell me. You know, some people say that was not his birth certificate. I'm saying I don't know. Nobody knows. And you don't know either, Jonathan. You're a smart guy. You don't know either.
Going back a few years, do you regret questioning President Obama's citizenship? Why or why not?
Not even a little bit. I don't regret it. Why would I regret it?
But he is a citizen. He produced that long-form birth cert.
Well, a lot of people don't agree with you, and a lot of people feel it wasn't a proper certificate.
You, almost single-handedly, were out there questioning President Obama's background. You said, how can you not show a birth certificate?
Right. But Trump comes along and said, birth certificate. He gave a birth certificate. Whether or not that was a real certificate, because a lot of people question it, I certainly question it.
It turned out to not be true.
Well, so I don't know. According to you, it's not true. I don't know.
He released his birth certificate.
You know, if you believe that
is not Muslim.
I really don't know. I don't know why he wouldn't release his records.
Born his birth certificate.
Who knows about Obama?
His mother was a U.S. citizen, born in Kansas.
You know,
was he a natural born citizen?
Who knows? Who knows? Who cares right now?
Do you think your birther position has hurt you among African Americans?
I don't know. I have no idea. I don't even talk about it anymore, Bill,
I just don't bother talking about it. You know.
I don't know. I guess with maybe some, I don't know why. I really don't know why. But I don't think very few people. You're the first one that's brought that up in a while.
Okay. And I have one more house lights. I got one more.
Now, answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. The
hey,
one
Chuck,
thing he
why,
got
hey,
right
Chuck.
Was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Okay. Okay, best gaslight of all time. I maintain that. All right, so let's get rolling here. So I have a list of questions that I'd like to ask my colleagues. So this is how this is going to go. What does it mean to gaslight from a communications perspective? I'm going to direct that to my colleague David Domke, after which I will follow up with a question, the same question from a clinical perspective, and then we'll go through three more additional questions, after which we'll open it up for Q&A. So first, Professor Domke, what does it mean to gaslight from a communications perspective?
Okay, thanks, Chris. The well, I've been thinking about this a little bit. That's a joke, all right? So I want to draw a distinction to start between reasonable disagreement that people who have political viewpoints might have versus outright falsehoods, okay? I think in American political arena, we've had many presidents who strongly adhere to certain ideological perspectives, and people who have a different worldview think that what they're having to say is just not accurate or not correct. And that may be so, but I want to kind of put those folks into a category of what I might just call ideologically inclined presidents. Franklin D. Roosevelt, very ideological president. Okay, Ronald Reagan, very ideological president. Now, these folks, if you in this room don't agree with them, you may say, you know what, they're not telling the truth. But that's not really the kind of people that I want to focus on here in terms of gaslighting with Trump. Those are folks that in the political arena are adhering, I think, by and large, to a deep ideological perspective that they have, who in that space don't live and breathe daily falsehoods. They speak the truths as they understand them. And they occasionally, like all politicians do offer falsehoods, because there isn't a single political leader in office who doesn't have to tell untruths at times. They may not be outright lies, but they may be nonetheless statements that they just know are not going to be true. Like, we will remove our troops at a certain time. Or we are going to get everybody covered with health care. These kinds of things. They're more aspirational, and so they're not true. And the person who says them knows they're not true, but they're not really, again, what we would call outright falsehoods. So I want to put reasonable, nonetheless ideologically inclined political leaders into one box and say that you may disagree with these individuals, and there may be others who you totally agree with that others think are crazy and are just over the beyond the pale ideologically, but they're not every day waking up and telling just things that are demonstrably false. Then there's this other category that I want to suggest is political leadership that has a dismissal for, a disregard for, and a disinterest in the truth. And these are folks who daily enact that. In our political presidential arenas, we can think of some of these folks, whether politicians generally or presidents in specific. A couple that I'll just mention would be Joseph McCarthy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon. These are folks who told outright lies, knew that they were not truthful, and set about trying to convince the American public on a daily basis that these were not correct, that these were not true, about a war, about the intentions or the patriotism, or about the reality of their own deception. These folks, again, in my definition of kind of what gaslighting looks like, is a dismissal for, a disinterest in, and a disregard for truth. And so they tell what are called, I would call, omnipresent untruths. Donald Trump falls into this category, in my view. Trump doesn't have near the political skills of those other individuals. But he's got a certain kind of skill set that is really well situated for today's culture, a culture that is media-centric, that is dominated by a attention span that's very short, doesn't follow up on claims and ask for evidence. So in all kinds of ways, he's situated for today. That distinction between those two, though, I think is really important to note, because what Trump is doing as a politician is telling outright falsehoods that are just not true. And that's different than ideologically inclined worldview claims. Second thing I want to say is that history has shown us so far that when politicians act this way, they eventually lose. They eventually are brought to heel and are forced to come to terms with those untruths, legally, politically. We don't know yet if that'll happen with Donald Trump. But the key to making it happen in those three previous instances that I mentioned, McCarthy, Johnson, and Nixon, was an unfettered press. A press that was relentless, relentless in going after what they saw as the truth. I believe we're, and I hope this, and I want to believe this, that we're in the early stages of that right now with Donald Trump. We certainly didn't have that during the campaign. But I believe that we're in the early stages of that right now. So I think that it's important for that to make sure that we give, it takes a little, to recognize that it takes a bit of time for that. We want it to happen now, but it takes time for other truth tellers to come forward and to make it known. So from a communications perspective, I want to just kind of make this point then, that we're not talking about the occasional untruth. We're talking about a foundational set of untruths that are just an omnipresent discourse. And constancy, that the press is central to kind of checking this. And the last thing I want to say is that these other individuals that I've mentioned came to power with a history of untruths also. They didn't come to power and then suddenly become untruthful. They have a history of lies. McCarthy about his claims about military. Lyndon Johnson and his the ways in which he rigged an election in Texas, claims about his own military endeavors. Richard Nixon about how he came to own a dog and much more. All right? So in the words of others, these folks are who they told us they were. They are. Donald Trump is that. And I'll just finish here and we can move on to the kind of clinical perspective. From a communications perspective, I don't know ultimately what the motives are. I only know what the words are. Now, we can speculate about the motives, but I don't know what the motives are. I just know what the words are. And right now, these words are dangerous. They are very dangerous for our system. But there are other words, too. And there are words like tonight, and there are words that you engage in, and there are words like the press and the words they put forward. And ultimately, I believe that that speech will win the day. But the dawn is not here yet.
Okay, thank you, David. I would like to push back on you on one thing. So you are a journalist by trade, you were a journalist, so I'm glad you brought that perspective out. But one of the things I wanted to push back on, the principal thing I would like to push back on, is you said Nixon, Johnson, and Joe McCarthy. One of these is not like the others. Right? And I'm going to give you a hint. His nickname was Tail Gunner. Tail Gunner Joe. So having said that, so one could say that, with Johnson, I don't know if there's such a thing as in reality as a white lie, but relative to what was going on with Tail Gunner Joe, and his communists or his witch hunts, I mean, those seem to be qualitatively different.
I'm not sure. I think we could have a next 4 or 5 hours of conversation about that. There's probably people in this audience who would say that Lyndon Johnson's decisions as president in terms of death, in terms of war, claims were worse than what McCarthy engaged in, right? That people died on his watch and we escalated a war effort that didn't need to be escalated. So I'm not sure about that. But I will say that in all three instances, it was the press that brought them down. It was Murrow with McCarthy, it was Cronkite with Johnson, and it was the Post and others on Watergate. So I think that they all told lies, perhaps for different reasons and with different effects, but all of them were flat-out untruths used for their own political purposes.
Okay. Roger that, David. Thank you. Keith, for the clinical perspective, please.
I brought notes here. So how many of you out there are therapists? Okay, wow. Got a few. How many of you are psychoanalytically oriented therapists? A few, okay. So the term gaslighting, of course, comes from the Patrick Hamilton's play Gaslight from 1939. And it was known in the United States as Angel Street. And then later it was made into a movie in 1944 called Gaslight with Charles Boyer and Joseph Cotten and Ingrid Bergman. And it takes place in the 19th century where the houses are lit with gas. And the victim's husband in the movie and in the play manipulated the gaslight in a way that made his wife's complaint seem as if she, about the flickering gaslights, made it seem as though she was going insane. And the husband's aim was to have her committed to a mental hospital so that he could gain the property for himself. Now, after that play came out, British psychoanalysts started using the term gaslight to mean to drive somebody crazy, to drive somebody psychotic. And that was kind of an early narrow definition of it. It's been broadened over time to describe one person trying to make another person, to try to undermine the victim's belief system and replace it with another belief system. And so that's clinically what happens in a lot of situations. Now, a local psychoanalyst, Ted Dorpat, wrote a book on gaslighting. It was called, it was called Gaslighting, the Double Whammy, Interrogation and Other Methods of Covert Control in Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis. And in that book, he identifies two defining characteristics of gaslighting. He says, one, the manipulation is one in which an individual attempts to exert control over the feelings, thoughts, or activities of another individual. And the second one is the practice is carried out covertly and is not explicitly, directly hostile, abusive, coercive, or intimidating. So this is so covert that the perpetrator may not even be aware that they're doing it. But it's used to disrupt another person's mental functioning, but not necessarily their behavior, although behavior could be included in the gaslighting concept. Ultimately, he comes to a what I think is a really good definition, very similar to what Chris put up there earlier, is that it is an attempt to influence the judgment of a second individual by causing them to doubt the validity of their own judgment and perceptions. Dorpat also goes on to talk about gaslighting as being common and maybe even ubiquitous in all communications. And it certainly happens, I think Chris alluded to this, it certainly happens in marriages a lot. Now, the double whammy that Dorpat talks about in his book, he says it's the double whammy. He says, first, the victim is verbally attacked, insulted, or disparaged. And then after that, after the victim has protested this, the victimizer again verbally abuses the victim by discrediting and invalidating the judgments made by the victim. So it goes something like this. You always do that wrong. You're such a loser. And then the other person would say, oh my God, that's really hurtful. That's terrible. And then the first person would say, oh, I'm just kidding. You know, can't you take a joke? You're being too overly sensitive. And so what happens is that they're verbally attacked, and then they have a reaction to that, and then the reaction is discounted. And that second attack is really the one that does people in. That's the one that invalidates their feelings. It's the one that makes them feel like they're no good, like they're stupid, and stuff like that. So this concept of gaslighting has kind of taken on other forms. It's sometimes called the double bind. A long time ago, we used to call it the schizophrenogenic situation, so where you drive somebody crazy. You put them in a double bind situation where no matter what they do, it's the wrong thing. I would also say that Dorpat's book on gaslighting is most of the book is devoted to the unconscious gaslighting techniques used by therapists on their clients. I'll move on from there. He also says it's used by totalitarian governments, fundamentalist religious groups, cults, encounter groups, and large group awareness training leaders. I don't think Dorpat had much use for large group awareness training leaders. So this is where I'll close by talking a little bit about the function of gaslighting. So clinically, when we think about gaslighting clinically, it's a primitive form of projection. And we're all kind of familiar with projection. Projection is where we say, oh, that's not me, that's you. It's not my fault, it's your fault. And it's a favorite defense used by adolescents, and it drives the adults around them absolutely crazy. You know, it's not, I didn't flunk that. It wasn't my fault I flunked that test. It was the teacher's fault. You know, the teacher didn't teach me right, or they didn't write a good test, or whatever. And so, you know, that's basic projection. What gaslighting is called projective identification. And it's an even more insidious kind of projection, because it not only projects onto another person the feelings that are inside the first person, but they're then treated in such a way that they begin to feel as though, feel the same way that the person who's projecting things onto them is. So it goes something like this. I feel stupid and like a loser. I don't like to feel stupid and a loser. So I act in such a way to make you feel stupid. By demeaning you or tricking you to the point where you question whether or not you really are stupid. And so that's kind of one of the most destructive parts of projective identification, is that if you can get the other person to believe those projections, to begin to act like the stupid person that you're trying to get them to believe, that's an incredibly destructive kind of thing. Now, if the intended victim can kind of pull away and say, no, I don't believe that. That's not what that's not what I think is true. Then you can kind of ward off a lot of that projective identification. I'll close this part of it by saying that we could assume that someone who uses gaslighting to make people feel stupid or like a loser have been made to feel that way themselves by the important people in their lives.
Thank you, Keith. Give him a hand, please. You gave David a hand. Please give Keith a hand. And, you know, like I did with David, I like to follow up with a couple questions. The first of which is, are there certain predispositive factors when it comes to gaslighting? That is to say, are there certain people that are predisposed to gaslighting, and are there to be on the receiving end of gaslighting, and whether or not it takes? And then, are there certain personality types or individuals that are more likely to attempt to gaslight?
Yeah. So to answer the first question, let me answer it by telling a brief story, if I can, if that's all right. I'll make it brief. So let me tell you a story. During the introduction, you heard that I've been in this business for almost 40 years. I've been a clinical director for 30 years. One of my areas of expertise is suicide. And so early on in the 80s, I co-authored a book on suicide. And then later on, when a new state law was passed in 2014 that required all mental health professionals to have 6 hours of training in suicide assessment, intervention, and treatment, I began to do a bunch of suicide workshops. So we've done about, my training partner and I have done about 30 workshops. We trained about 3,500 people over the course of the last 3 years. So in the process of doing that, I've learned a lot, not only about suicide, but about homicide as well, because they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And so when we start to think about the facts of suicide, so let me tell you just a couple of things about suicide and homicide and the relationship between them. And what I'm about to tell you is stuff that you'll probably already know. It's stuff that you may not have the exact numbers to put on them, but you'll have a general sense as to what I'm about to say to you. So what I would say is that over the last 15 years, the suicide rate has increased considerably, and now it's the highest rate that it's ever been in this country's history. Despite that, though, the murder rate in the United States is twice the suicide rate. And 3/4 of all deaths by gun in Washington State are murder. Men die by suicide less often than women, and the adolescent suicide rate is higher than the adult rate. And because of years of oppression and racism and slavery the African American suicide rate is about 5 times that of the white, non-Hispanic white rate. So does that, as I talk about that, does that sound reasonable? Does that sound right?
I was actually going to go to the race card after this.
That's okay. Yeah, all right. You. Okay. So does that kind of seem, I mean, is that set right? Does that seem about right for everybody? Okay. Well, everything I just told you is not only a lie. It's basically the opposite of the truth. So, you know, what I'm saying is that, so let's kind of quickly deconstruct what happens. Those of you who actually believe me, you know, let's deconstruct this. So
wait, you're gaslighting us right now.
I am. I'm gaslighting you right now. And part of my point is that we're all susceptible to gaslighting. Nobody is immune to gaslighting. So what I did was I said, let me tell you a story. And when I say tell and story in the same sentence, that makes me automatically more credible, more empathetic, and you more friendly to me. You'd like me more when I say I'm going to tell you a story, because we kind of know what to do with that. And then I established myself as an expert in the field. And then I said to you, you know, you all will know this. This will all sound very obvious to you. And I played to this idea that we all have, that we have a pretty good sense of what's around us, and we have a pretty good sense of the world. And so the suicide rate in the United States has increased over the last 15 years, but it's still lower than it was in 1950, 1960, 1970, and 1980. The gun deaths in Washington State, the murder rate is half the suicide rate. It's half, not twice. It's half the suicide rate. The murder rate is less. 3/4 of all gun deaths in Washington State are suicide, not homicide. The adolescent suicide rate is lower than the adult rate, and the white, non-Hispanic white suicide rate is 5 times the African-American suicide rate. So everything was basically the opposite of what I said. And so when I begin to talk, you all begin, and if you found me, you know, kind of sympathetic and you liked me and you found that I was friendly and, you know, kind of an expert on things, you begin to think of stories that confirmed what I was telling you. Maybe you searched your memory and you hear a lot more about murders than you do suicides. And there's a reason for that, because ethical reporting says you don't report the details of suicide. Because of fear of contagion effect. And you may have heard of somebody who committed suicide, who died by suicide, and probably the last person you heard about maybe was Robin Williams, maybe? But you heard a lot about murders, right? You hear about murder all the time. So as you go searching your memory, you access these things that confirm what I have to say. And so that happens all the time. So when I don't know how many tweeters there are in here, but when you get a fact tweeted to you and you retweet that without thinking about it, this is what happens. You say, oh, that sounds right. That sounds like a fact. That sounds reasonable. And then we repeat that as the fact. And when in fact, that's not what happens. There's a lot of reasons for this. And I'll shut up here in a minute, I promise. There's a lot of reasons for this. And part of the problem is that we have basically been designed by evolution to accept alternative facts, to not think through things very carefully. We have this system inside of us that's really good at keeping us alive, at survival, and it's got probably hundreds of millions of years of evolution behind it. And then we have this kind of frontal lobe thing that has been evolving for a couple of 100,000 years. And so you've got 1 million years of this kind of survival thing, and you've got a couple 100,000 years of this executive functioning thing, and the survival thing is always going to win. How many of you are familiar with Daniel Kahneman's work on, yes, so this is System 1 and System 2. Kahneman wrote a book, he's written a lot of stuff, but it's How People Make Decisions. You familiar with Kahneman? Yeah, Thinking Fast and Slow. Great book. If you haven't read Thinking Fast and Slow, read it. It's really great, but it explains a lot of this. But it basically says that we have this other system that we can use, but it's kind of lazy. And it kind of gives seeds power to System 1, which collects all these facts and all this information and does it really quickly and does it out of our awareness. Basically what he says is System 1 is who you are and System 2 is who you think you are. So we're all of us are vulnerable to gaslighting. All of us are vulnerable to alternative facts. And yes, there are some personalities that are more likely to gaslight, but they're people who have been gaslit themselves, if that's a word. They're people who have been abused. They're people who have been ignored and abused and demeaned, and then they have to get that out and do that and create that in somebody else so that they feel better. That's the long answer, sorry.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the dissertation, Keith. So let's swing back a little bit to this side. But I did have a question, however, because it suggests that from what you said, and because I got to be honest with you, before being approached about the gaslighting phenomena, David and I both admitted to ourselves via text, do you know what it means to, do you know what gaslighting means? I'm like, man, I just found out a couple days ago, man. So, because I had heard it thrown around so often. But let me, so I kind of want to, we can revisit this in Q&A if you guys wish, but I kind of want to throw it open to my colleagues right now. Can gaslighting occur at a group level? And I ask this question because often racism is denied. Like somebody will tell me racism doesn't exist. I'm like, man, how the fuck are you gonna tell me racism does not exist? I live this every day. Pardon the French, but whatever, right? It's like, I live this every day, so how are you gonna tell me racism doesn't exist? Same thing when it comes to sexism, right? You have men that'll tell women or believe that sexism does not exist, right? So I guess I wanna throw it open to my colleagues. It's like, can this occur at the group level? And it seems to me, moreover, there is this presumption of, or maybe this activation of power. It seems like there's a power dynamic, if you will, that is associated with gaslighting. And so I'm just gonna throw this open, to my two colleagues here. What do you guys think about that? Do you find any validity in either one of those claims?
When you say does it happen at the group level? Let me just make sure I'm asking. You mean, can a speaker or a group of speakers convince a certain group of people of a certain set of alternative facts? Is that what you mean?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It would seem like that's what happens in politics. So maybe we need political gaslighting as opposed to interpersonal, relational gaslighting, right? That political gaslighting is the skill set, the ability to put forward through repetition, through an unconscionability about the falsehoods one's telling, in such a way that you're able to convince that you believe that you can, and then you are able to convince a significant subgroup of the American electorate of those alternative facts that you're claiming. So that the claim that, of course, that not only is this president a bad president, not the former president, President Obama, not only is he supposedly a bad president, but that he's not an American citizen, that he's a Muslim. Right? And so who believes that? Well, you're targeting that to certain groups of people. You don't expect everybody to buy that. You are thinking that there will be a certain subset of group of people, and that will be particularly white working class men. That's a reality. And it is those folks of people that I think are the most susceptible politically in this moment of a diversifying the United States, of a globalizing economic space, of a media system that doesn't look like them except on certain cable channels, that are most susceptible to this at this time politically.
Okay, so I need to push back on you on that for a sec, David. So this is my part of my ongoing research. It is a fact that, you know, Trump won 48% of white college-educated voters, first of all. Second of all, like with the Tea Party work, you had a lot of people who were fairly well-educated and doing really well who supported the Tea Party. And then if we think about the proportion of working class whites, and this has been sticking in my craw ever since this stuff came out, is that everyone wants to attribute, progressives included, you know, Trump's victory to working class whites. That's just not true. Working class whites only constitute 36% of the electorate, and Trump only won 2/3 of that. So one of the things I want to bring out here, and thank you for helping me out with this, is that this is not about working class whites. The reason why this is so important is because it's going to lead to faulty policy prescriptions in adjusting the economy to accommodate working class whites. These jobs are not coming back. The fact of the matter is you had a lot of white educated people who supported Trump, right? That's just true. Now, whether or not they're more susceptible to gaslighting, I'll defer to you on that. But I know for a fact, when we look at the exit polling and when we look at what's going on theoretically, that it's not mainly working class whites. They're a part of it, but that presumes that, you know, that well-educated or white folks who have not been left behind by globalization, that they didn't support Trump in enough numbers to get him over the top. And that's just simply not true.
Yeah, I didn't say that. What I said is that a certain body of people are more susceptible to it in our political system than others. And that those body of people were the folks that he was speaking to. That others came along and supported him, I think, is a different situation, okay? I think, though, that he built his base, as every politician needs to, with a certain body of people. And his base was ready for his message and these alternative facts that he presented, and continues to be. You look at the NBC Wall Street Journal poll over the weekend, his approval rating among white working class men is 64 to 28. That's non-college educated. That's how it's defined. Non-college educated white men. Among college educated white men, it's exactly the opposite, 28 to 64. Exactly the opposite. So his base is those folks. That's not the only people who voted for him, but it is his base politically. And so when he set out to build a base, what did he go with? He went on a racist message, the birther message. That's what brought him into the political arena. That was not a message tailored to the masses. That was tailored to a certain body of people.
Okay, so at the very end of this, I have a data analysis that I'm going to show everybody. And this is from the Washington poll. And then, you know, and we can sort this out then. I'm not gainsaying what David's saying, but I think there's part of that that's true. But I'm saying when you do a more comprehensive data analysis, the whole class thing completely falls out. So I love this guy. We go after each other like this all the time. So Keith, so can you comment on what David said? Not necessarily about, you know, well, you can comment on whatever you want to comment on. but what I'm more interested in, and hopefully you guys are as well, is whether or not this phenomenon of gaslighting can be extended to the group level. That is to say, is it possible for, you know, white folks to gaslight people of color and men to gaslight women? Or can it work in the opposite direction?
Yeah, you know, I think it can work at the group level. I think it's more effective at the individual level. I think it's more effective when you have a relationship, a direct relationship. You know, I'm not sure that Trump has persuaded anybody who didn't already agree with him. Mm-hmm. And most of his gaslighting is, we were talking about this, Dave and I were talking about this before. You know, we're not here tonight because Trump is a great gaslighter. We're here because he's an obvious gaslighter, and it pisses us off because it's so obvious. But it's not particularly good, and it's not particularly effective. I think a lot of the people that David was talking about earlier were a lot better at it. So yes, I think gaslighting can happen, but I think it's much more effective when you have an individual or personal relationship with somebody. It's much easier to dominate and to get in and do something like that.
Chris, can I just add your question?
Yeah.
Can it happen at the group level, men to women, white to African Americans? It seems to me that gaslighting inherent in the political system involves power. Okay, it involves power. So certainly someone who's an African-American person in a society can gaslight to white Americans, but it's unlikely that they have the power to operate upon that in the same way as a white person does, right? And so gaslighting to me gains the sinister aspects politically when it's coupled with power, right?
No, that's, yeah.
And that's what we see in domestic violence situations. Yeah, you see that kind of power and control. I mean, whether domestic violence isn't just hitting people, it's really a power and control kind of thing. And there's a lot of gaslighting that goes on in a domestic violence situation. And so, yeah, it's where one person has more power than another, and in many cases, physical.
Okay, so we got the light signal. I don't know what that means. If we have 5 minutes left of Q&A, 10 minutes, can somebody, like, throw up a card or something like that back there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip to, okay, so I'm going to skip to the last question if you guys
No, I think that was a photo.
Oh, that was a photo?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Kellyanne Conway was back here, right? Kellyanne's
in the back. So I do fear, however, that we're running short on time. So if you guys don't mind, can we skip to the last question and just ask, does the present case of gaslighting pose a threat to American democracy? So let's swing it back over here to David.
Does it pose a threat to America? This is our last question then before Q&A, right? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Does it pose a threat to American democracy? Absolutely. Does it pose an existential threat? I believe it does. Does it pose a never seen before threat to American democracy? No, not in my view. We have seen great threats to this country's standing. You can go all the way back to the as far back as you want to go. There are people that have done terrible things that have posed existential threats to this democracy. What I do think makes this moment different, though, is that we have an ability as a public to silo ourselves from that press that I spoke about at the beginning, so that we do not encounter news in the same way that we used to. We get to select into news cycles. So that's why I don't know if the press's persistence at this time will have the same outcome as it had before because of that situation. So does it pose a threat? Yes. Existential? Yes. Is it greater than ever before? Probably not. But I don't know, and so I'm sufficiently concerned about it that I'm not prepared to spend the rest of my career as an academic.
Can you elaborate? Would you elaborate on that, please?
So, you know, I've made a decision that I'm leaving the university in a couple years to engage in the public arena, in the political space, in a way that I think is more hands-on. I think it's a privileged opportunity to be at a university. And so, but, you know, my wife is like, what? And so, but the reality is it's not just that. It's that I do believe that this moment is significant enough. Yeah. It is, right? And, you know, I did this came after the decision. I mean, I was doing a talk about a month ago, and I was finishing the talk, and I said, look, there are people in this room who have fought and died for this. I mean, not who didn't die, but know people who died for this country. There are others of you that fought for this country, and I'll be damned if this country's going down on my watch. Right? And so the reality is that it's so much bigger than this little town hall moment. It's about the globe. So is it, yes, is it gonna not end our experiment democracy? I don't know. I hope not, but I don't know. And so that's why we're here. Yeah.
Thank you, David. Please give him a hand, please. Keith?
I think it does pose a threat. I think, though, and that gaslighting has always gone on. It will always go on, and there may be not a whole lot we can do about it. But what we can do is pay attention to ourselves. We can't control what other people do, but we can control what we do. And so, what we have to do is we have to slow down. We have to think. We have to think things through. And we probably have to do one of the hardest things that we can possibly do. I think it's been my experience, and the longer I stay in this business, the more I understand it this way, that nothing good happens, relatively little happens that's good outside of the context of a relationship. And so you have to have a relationship with someone in order to be able to persuade them. You're not going to be able to persuade somebody by yelling at them. You're not going to be able to persuade somebody by throwing rocks at them. What you have to do is one of the hardest things to do is to befriend a Trump supporter and make them your friend and listen first. And then if we can listen first, then we can speak. But we have to listen first. So in order to be able to save the institutions that are so precious to us, and particularly the press, I'm really worried about the attacks on the press. I think that's one of the things that is most alarming about what Trump's been doing so far. We have to be able to step back, and we have to be able to think this stuff through, and we have to be able to support a free press. But we, in order to do that, we have to have a relationship. We have to go outside of our circle. We have to be able to make relationships with other people and to then persuade them once we're inside the relationship, not outside the relationship.
Okay, thank you, Keith. Give him a hand, please.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. University of Washington professors Christopher Sebastian Parker and David Domke joined Wellspring Family Services Vice President Keith Myers at Town Hall Seattle on February 27th. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You'll find the full version and many other great talks on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon. We'll be right back.